feast on this one.
Conceptuality is something other than itself.
There's been a change in the image of thought.
That's what it is.
That's what it is.
That's what it is.
The internal structure of becoming.
As soon as an utterance slips from the mouth, it's divorced from the subject.
All right, want to do some Derrida?
Yeah.
So you're teaching this tonight. I didn't get a chance to read your lecture because I was reading the chapter,
fucking,
but I'll
read
that later.
Cash money, man. It's cash money. I put in a little note for Boo Boo. Did you read it, Boo Boo?
Yeah, but I didn't see my note. Wait.
No, it was totally directed. The which, by the way, if the inadequacy is necessary and constitutive, one might eventually begin to suspect that it isn't an inadequacy at all.
Oh, yes. That is definitely directed to me.
I was writing it last night. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you can tell I got to the point at about page four that I was just like, okay, fucking notes.
Right.
I can't do this anymore, but... I'm trying to run a line with each class, like a particular sort of point of emphasis, and hopefully this one is the what it means to do something under erasure. That's really what the topic of this one is, like what he's trying to do with the under erasure thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to read that because that's, to me, the most mind-bending aspect of this.
That's why that quote that I use is the epigraph. It was just one random sentence that I came across because I read it this weekend, and then I read it again on Monday, and it was the second with Derrida, man. I'm just telling you, I mean, because I've read this probably five times before, and you just have to read it multiple times, and you just have to work through it sentence by sentence. Like, the best way to read Derrida, I've decided for me, is to write it when I am like reading it and taking notes and reading and taking, like, that's the best way to. So writing a lecture is actually the best way to read Derrida for me. I found. I mean, it really is. It's like, that's what I get. And so that's the sentence. And I think the sentence that's the epigraph is great. I mean, it's just...
That was one of my favorite sentences. I'm just looking at it right now.
It's such a great... Because it's all right there in that, like... You know, that's what... Usually he'll do that as like a preface or a sentence or something like that. But like... But I just love that... There's only two words, the rationality, but perhaps that word should be abandoned for reasons that will appear at the end of the sentence. But the sentence doesn't go on in that long, torturous way that he usually does.
Yeah.
It's like, which governs the writing, thus enlarged and radical, no longer issues from a logos. It's pithy, it's succinct, and it erases itself, but it doesn't erase itself, right? It does sort of both, you know?
I'm going to read it again without the interjection, just quickly for listeners. The rationality which governs a writing thus enlarged and radicalized no longer issues from a logos. And then in there is like, maybe there's something a little bit odd about beginning the sentence with rationality, because by the time you get to the end of it, the logos has been called into question under erasure.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's sort of how, and the other thing that struck me in reading Grammatology, particularly the, you know, first 90 or so pages, it really is an argument. Like, I say all the time that Derrida inhabits the structure, but he doesn't in these 90 pages, right? Like, the reading of Rousseau, more so, right? Like, the next 100 and plus, but here, he makes an argument, and it's almost schematic. Like, there are places where I'm like, well, he's using Aristotle as an example and Hegel as an example, but he's making a really, really big claim saying there's no exceptions to this, that I'm like, I can imagine somebody reading this as sort of dissertation-y type thing and being like, you're using very minimal amounts of evidence to make this massive claim about the history of philosophy, you know? It's a claim, it's an argument. This is dependent upon that. Now, of course, he's going to say, you know, this is dependent on a logic of metaphysics, but metaphysics is not the only thing, you know? But it's very segmented. Like, the first... Like, what we read so far doesn't really get at the notion of the trace at all, right? So the trace comes later, even though there's this sort of metaphoricity move. So he makes the move towards the sensible, the name for writing in the heart, the good writing, right, is always a metaphor. And so it's metaphoricity. It's like that move is the move of the logic of the trace and of difference, but it's not really focused on and not really pointed out. you know.
Well, here's what does not read like a dissertation of it is, yes, he's making massive claims, but, you know, how many of these first pages are solely dedicated to getting at the precision of that claim and setting it up that claim so it's even or just the target so it's possible to be heard. That, I mean, the patience required to do that is just truly impressive to me.
And the stuff on, I mean, the stuff on linguistics, like, I don't know if you guys, did you guys just do the 25, first 25 pages? The next stuff on linguistics, I mean, there's, like, the Saussure stuff I know well, so I sort of immerse myself with the Saussure, but he's, like, Jakobson, Helmslev, like, he's doing the late 60s linguistics stuff, too, not just, you know, the Saussure and its impact. So it's, like, there's just big chunks of that that I'm, like, I have nothing to say about it because I don't know it. I mean, I don't, you know. And I kind of wonder, I mean, that's one of the questions that I always have is I feel like sometimes I'm teaching Saussure in order to teach Derrida. And is Saussure even relevant in linguistics anymore? Like, at all? Like, is it, or are we keeping Saussure alive in order to keep alive the critique of Saussure?
Right, yeah.
You know?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if Saussure is actually even cited in, like, linguistics as a field anymore. I feel like he's kept alive more in English, sort of through Derrida.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Right. Well, that's what I'm asking. Like, in terms of, like, how does this work? And again, I don't know linguistics at all. Like, but I'm guessing, like, the Chomsky deep grammar stuff. Like, how does this play out? Is there a Saussure in, like, the Anglo-American tradition in the last 30 years, right? Or something that is kind of like, you know, what Saussure did in terms of... I believe that European linguistics, I totally believe Saussure was hugely influential. Structural linguistics, like Levi-Strauss, anthropology, Bart, obviously, right? Like, there's huge influences there. But has it mattered in the last 40 years in the Anglo-American... I have no idea.
You know? I mean, I don't know in terms of sort of like the theoretical groundings, but just when I was at South Carolina speaking to linguist students, because it was nice that you ran into them in the English department there, and, you know, they would talk to me about their projects, like, it was seemed to be, I mean, they were usually like ethnographic, a lot of sort of like listening to to discourse communities and then sort of like breaking down the sort of linguistic structures involved.
The sociolinguistic types.
Right. Yeah, kind of like empirical studies of
very
foreign
much
languages.
Empirical. Very much so about coding. But how could you imagine that kind of apparatus without the sort of structure of the sign signifier, or the signifier signified?
Right. That's where I suspect that Derrida is right in that regard, like, and is still right in the sense of you can't imagine a linguistics that doesn't have some version of signifier signified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, like, and now, but I do think that you can imagine one that doesn't have a version of differences without positive terms, right? Like,
right.
I mean, I mean, I'm not saying, but that it exists, but that it's. I mean, that's one of the things that's. Saussure provides the great linchpin for why there cannot be language, why the concept of language as a totality, which is required by him, can't actually exist. So it's just because of differences without positive terms, right? Like. Yeah. You can't have a totality constituted by difference.
Yeah, but that was, I mean, my sample size is like three people that I knew at South Carolina, but I very distinctly remember in talking with them the sort of the arbitrary, like they're listening to them talk about the theoretical foundations. It was very much so a matter of the arbitrary designation of, you know, these terms that are all based on differentials. So, like, I mean, that, and look, I don't even think that you need. What I like about the opening arguments here, the opening sort of like paving, is he starts incredibly broad, and something like linguistics is very frankly it's certainly a pertinent example, but it's an example among anything else. He brings up the example of you know the biological writing as well, and like the you know the sort of broader. Umbrella that he's creating here is just some kind of science writing, right? Both a science of writing or the writing of science and math. And, you know, to me, it's actually when he's talking about math and he's talking about the the essential. No, well, the essential or the ideality of the form of identity, right? That you can't have math without the concept of one, right? Of the unified one. And then you can start to break that one down, you know, in into differentials, into decimals. You can say that it's arbitrary, you know. And this is on page 10, by the way, that first full paragraph. We have already right, alluded to the theoretical mathematics, its writing, whether understood as a sensible graphy, the manner of writing, and that already presupposes an identity, therefore an ideality of its form, which in principle renders absurd the quickly admitted notion of the sensible signifier, or understood as the ideal synthesis of signifieds or a trace operative on another level, or yet more profoundly as a passage from one to the other, has never been absolutely linked with the phonetic production. And then he goes on later to sort of like to turn to the to episteme and historia, right, as the sort of like two sides of the same coin. But like he's what he's setting up here is this sort of three-part movement from speech as that which is closest to the soul, to writing as that which is the representation of the soul, and then the intensification of that movement to re-articulate or to sort of like reinterpret that relationship to a prior writing that the phoné, the speaking, is just itself a representation of, and that, you know, that the representation of being as presence, which would be a full, complete writing, you know, the writing on the soul, the writing of truth, the, like, you know, you could use the biological language here, the information of DNA, whatever you want it to be.
Well, but back on the math question, because to me, the math thing here, he's, in that section on 10, he finds math interesting, like as something that challenges the metaphysics of presence, right? Like, because to me, in those moments, I mean, he goes through a whole series, yeah. Like starting on 9, it's like the cinematography, choreography, that all these things mm-hmm. of writing, the program of the living cell. But I mean, I think in cybernetics, he names, and by under the name of cybernetics, I think he means information, what we would call information
yeah.
theory,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And that's yeah. all of engineering. That's all yeah. like the sort of mathematization of things, right? Like, so what's interesting in regard to the information theory stuff is that there's no signified, right? There is no, you know, there's no signifier-signified relation. It's just information and repetition.
But it's purity. It's the purity of the information, right?
Right,
which is
that's
why
right. That's all it is.
Right, which is, I mean, and this is, you know, so he sets this up from the very beginning, and this is where it gets to those questions of erasure that, like, if I approach it from this perspective, I can see the way that erasure is working, but if I approach it from any other perspective, it's a little bit too confounding for me. I think this is actually in the epilogue, but, like, this is the he's, like, first off, he's, you know, contextualizing, you know, sort of the exigence of this. Like, why is he writing about language and writing at this moment? And in some ways, you know, there's an intensification of the sighing of the sign, you know, the right. sighing of language that has inflated itself to the point of like stretching beyond its function. And in doing so, it is it's revealing perhaps a logic that that's already been there. It required a certain kind of intensification to realize, or maybe it's a mutation, whatever it might be, but. You know, the center of this ontotheological metaphysics has generally been presumed to be the phoné, the logos closest to the soul, and then everything else is derivative of that, supplemental, like writing a supplemental. But that supplementarity has effaced itself. That writing itself, there's the shift from language, the primacy of language, to the primacy of writing. But you have to think of writing, a different sense of writing, a writing that is not the repetition of the phoné, but as the pure presence of information, right? The pure presence of the writing of God, the writing of nature through some kind of natural affinity, right? And that is, you know, that would, like,
well, that no, that's I don't because that's the old one. The old one is presumed that there's some pure presence of the idea, the essence or whatever that then falls. Whereas, I mean, to me, you know, what he says about math here is, within cultures practicing so-called, this is on 10 right after what you said, within cultures practicing so-called phonetic writing, mathematics is not just an enclave. That is mentioned by all historians of writing. They recall at the same time the imperfections of alphabetic writing, which passed for so long as the most convenient and most intelligent writing. This enclave is also the place where the practice of scientific language challenges intrinsically and with increasing profundity the ideal of phonetic writing and all its implicit metaphysics, metaphysics itself. Particularly, that is, the philosophical idea of the episteme, also of historia, a concept profoundly related. That's where it goes. So in that sense, it's like the mathematization is a challenge, right? Because it doesn't... Now, I think what he's interested in here, and he doesn't spell it out, but my sense of what he's interested in here is, how do you go, in a sense, how do you go from theoretical physics, which is an entirely mathematical operation, to, like, any conversation about astronomy or anything, right? Like, that's the link that I would imagine kind of reintroduces, you know, but the sort of pure math part of it, this just like, I mean, he says mathematical theory, I mean, that's what he names there. Mathematical theory is not invested in a representational relationship at all, you know. It is just...
Because it's the Ur, right? I mean, that the way that I took it is that that's the Ur. You know, I mean, I had in the back of my head signature event context in sort of like thinking about this sort of, you know, language, writing, and then another kind of more general kind of writing that governs all of it, right? And I see a different architecture going on in that essay than I do here, right? Because in signature event context, the sort of the new writing that is revealed is irreducible to, I mean, it is iteration, right? It is citationality itself, it is difference, right? At least what he's doing in the opening here is I don't see that yet. I see the it's almost like the ontotheological program of being as pure presence and the primacy that it places on the phonetic, the voice, the breath, everything, sort of like the near semblance, in its intensification, it renders that even that inadequate. And then almost paradoxically, it turns to the pure sign, the pure pure information as its source, as its criterion of judgment.
So that's not how I was thinking of it. I mean, I'm not sure on that. He doesn't say enough about math, and I don't know. I don't really understand the things he is saying about math.
Right.
So to me, like, that whole passage is, look, there's been this metaphysics of presence connected to the ontotheological voice thing, right? And that has been the sort of domain for 2,000 years.
Yeah.
In the last century or so, there are a bunch of efforts that problematize the ease with which that is assumed. And now one can find it in very different kinds of areas. One is the importance of graphing, right? Like the choreography, cinematography, like the graphing, the notion of a program, right? Like the cell, the DNA writing. So, I mean, and what they're doing is they're taking a notion of writing more important than language, which is not a writing of language, it's just a writing. You know, so in each of those cases, writing becomes not just a derivative, like the old metaphysical tradition, but actually an enactment, and a doing something. And he sees that, to me, in cybernetics, information theory, all of these things. Now, that's not to say that they aren't then rehooked to metaphysical programs in other ways, but to me, it seems like he's just saying, I'm not the figurehead for this movement. This movement is happening. I'm simply noting it's occurring across a whole series of different fields, that there's a troubling of the metaphysics. So I'm going to now lay out for you the metaphysics, and I'm going to lay out for you the challenges within a philosophical register, not within a choreographic, like military and political writing is another one that he talks about. Like, I'm not going to talk about it in those registers. I'm going to talk about it in the philosophical register. So to me, in that sense, math is the math is a location that troubles the ease of metaphysics. Now, not that metaphysics can't be totally reappropriated around the notion of knowledge, right? Like, so that pure math comes to mean or refer to how do you build the bridge, or how, you know, where is Mars, or and things like that. So it can have a kind of representational efficacy. But
well, it seems like maybe he's also saying, like, these fields in the last century or so are performing this kind of deconstruction of metaphysics without being reflexive or conscious that deconstruction. So I'm Derrida. I'm going to kind of articulate this problematic as it's performed throughout these various disciplines.
I agree. Yeah, that's my sense. It's exactly what you just said. They're doing something that troubles the metaphysics, right. And I'm going to show you the logic of the things that they are doing.
Right.
You know, right. But he's going to work it in a specifically philosophical register, not about, you know, the cell or anything else.
Right.
So I'm looking at that passage. I mean, it's just fascinating to me that I'm reading this in the exact opposite lens, from the exact opposite lens. I agree with the overarching claim that you're making, that Derrida is not claiming that he's, you know, doing all of this from, you know, ex nihilo, that there have been these kind of challenges to it. I'm just taking the register or the sense of those challenges in a very different way than where I imagine Derrida is going to go with it. You know, I'm looking at on page 9, the one on the biological program. The sentence cell. Right before that, you know, all this is to describe not only the system of notation secondarily connected with these activities, so that which would be the sort of the secondary derivative, like we're going to write about the way that the cell is doing, but a metaphor is going to be installed into the very logic of how we think about cells operating. So for the most elementary process,
No, not only a system of, so writing is not just a notion of notation secondarily connected with the activities. It's the essence and content of the activities themselves.
The essence and the content of these activities.
Right, writing becomes primary.
Exactly, but what sense of writing here? Because I'm not reading that in the performative, iterative, citational sense of writing.
Oh, but I think that's totally what he's saying. Like I think it's totally like. What's going on here is a spreading of a logic of writing, of grammatology, that I didn't come up with, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, as Nietzsche said, they're doing this thing. I am simply going to unpack the logic of it. Again, not to say that it's not reappropriated in each of these fields around a metaphysics, of course, but that once you start thinking writing is primary and not a secondary or derivative component of an idea, which is like DNA, right? Yeah. Like, in that sense, there isn't some idea of DNA, it makes cells, right? So the writing of, you know, cellular transcription in that case, and that's where information theory becomes interesting. There's no signified in information theory, right? Mm-hmm. It is simply the repetition of the information itself. That's what a signal is all pure information and repetition.
Right.
You know, so that's where I see, like, one might also
have an incredibly imminent view of that information, because if we can stick with the biological example for a second, maybe I'm just sort of like have a problematic commonplace understanding of that logic, but when I hear a biologist, or just sort of like in common parlance, you know, the metaphor of the DNA is that yes, the DNA itself is replicated, right, but that DNA is the information of the body, right? So, like, that is, it has that sort of telos potentiality, the exact same kinds of logic that Aristotle would locate in the acorn, that, you know, like, within this information, that information expressed is an arm, or is, like, blue eyes, or something like that. And it's in the replication of that as information.
Right, but I mean, you'd have to do. I mean, he just has a sentence, so we're taking a lot. Yeah. I mean, all the sentences. Yeah, yeah. It is also in this sense that the contemporary biologist speaks of writing and the program in relation to the most elementary process of information within the living cell. Right, like that's all he says about it. But I mean, my take there is yes, I get your point, which is that's a way of reappropriating it, which is that the signified is the sort of DNA architecture that then expresses itself in proteins or whatever else. But you actually think it's not just a code that means blue eyes, it's the blue eyes.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's not just what's behind blue eyes. Sorry, that was my Who reference. No one knows what it's like to be the sad man behind blue eyes.
Behind Tommy, blue can eyes. You hear me?
Right. But it's not just a program that is run for something else. And I honestly think, for instance, he doesn't say very much about it. Let's agree on that one, right? Like that all. But I think that what he says here is that the logic of writing has started to spread.
Right.
And the important part is that writing is not derivative. So when we talk about choreography, right, we are talking about graphing writing of mm-hmm. bodies, right? Of a core, you know. So that's what you're doing. You are not. So the writing then becomes a kind of primary operation for producing actions, and you can see it in cellular biology. You can see it in information theory. You can see it in all these places. Now that he's not saying, I don't think that these things are sort of radicalized. He mm-hmm. wants to radicalize the implications of taking on this primary writing thing.
Right.
I don't think he thinks that they have done that. So, I mean, I can imagine there's a critique of cybernetics in here, too, which is, of course, it can get re-territorialized. It maybe has to be re-territorialized on some notion of information from and to, right? Like,
right. I mean,
I'm guessing.
One way also, like, you could say that these fields are taking part in a shift in theoretical orientation right. without being cognizant of the implications of that shift. So like there's been a
right.
change in the image of thought, like to borrow Deleuze's term, which enables right. cybernetics, biology to kind of employ imminently this writing in general that's outside right. of the metaphysics of presence, but they're not sufficiently or aware of the implications of this shift. So Derrida, the exigence for Derrida is like, I'm going to outline these implications philosophically that are kind
right.
of like
that's right.
imminent or latent in
and radicalize. I mean, he'll right. use that term not like to radicalize the insights, because the reason I don't think it's the version that you're talking about, Nathaniel, is because like the notion of the book of nature has always mm-hmm. been around, right? Like mm-hmm. that's not, I mean, that's a commonplace way of thinking of like nature is out there.
Right.
It's this is book and we read it, right? So that notion mm-hmm. of writing and reading in relationship to nature, to me, if you're marking a change, it's the change of, like I said, a kind of information, what I think of as Claude Shannon, right? Information theory. This is just stuff from the 40s that I read. I mean, and I don't know very well, right? Like I just sort of cursory learned it 20 years ago or something. But that's where like the materiality of stuff is nothing but information, right? Like that's, mm-hmm. it's not like there's information at its core that makes for the materiality of stuff. It is, no, the materiality of stuff is, that's all that a signal is in information theory, is pure information, mm-hmm. you know.
So how would you then explain something, because I mean, a phrase that I hear a whole lot in scientific discourse is like, one must gather information, as if like information, I mean, that to me, that is completely opposed to a notion of like information as citational repetition of material structures.
Yeah, like, let me also say, I'm certain that science doesn't play this out. Like, I mean, I think that's that critique of science that he has even on the page before, where it's like, science, there's some things happening in science with math, especially pure math, right, where mm-hmm. it doesn't care about its representational efficacy. It's just following out the logic of mathematics that's really interesting. As it becomes a science, it's fucking hooked to the episteme. It can't not be,
mm-hmm.
right? So
right.
it gets re-articulated around knowledge, and then it's like, well, that's the old game, right? Like, that is a way of re-hooking this thing, you know? So it's like, okay, there has to be some representational payoff for all of these mathematical theory you're doing. But I don't know.
What's more book of nature than saying, like, math is the thing itself, and then everything else
right.
about it is a derivative representation of it?
It depends on what you mean by that, because there would be no derivative repetition then, right? It would simply be the book
within
of nature.
The realm of math, right? Because I mean, like,
right.
here's the hook. It's like, within the realm of math, that would be like the pure utterance of God, right? That would be just like, it wouldn't be representing anything else. It would only be
right.
expressing its own like attributes and its other, the infinity
right.
of its own attributes, right?
The infinity of its
but
own
then,
mathematical, right?
Exactly, right? That would be like Spinoza's God, right?
Right.
But then
right.
to say anything about it would be to plug that pure, you know, unspoiled mathematical, you know, language, non-language, like mathematical pure writing, the book of mathematics, or the pure writing of mathematics, and then plug it into a scientific program that utters truths about it. And then that would have to be all derivative, a translation of the more primary, you know, and that's the
so
same
that's
way.
That's the whole problem is, at least to me, is how do you hook mathematics to natural languages, right? Like, in other words, how do you take mathematical equations and translate them into what it means? That then becomes the area of producing episteme and producing knowledge, you know, and it reintroduces all of the same problematics.
Right, because you'd have to go, and I think what he does later is make the exact opposite move, and it's not that there's math and then there are representations about math, and then there are writings about the phonetic representations of, you know, the real, you know, ding on zick mathematics. Yeah. It's that, no, we need to take the logic of the mathematics, and especially it's sort of as a program, as something that is constantly unfurling itself, that doesn't have a static center of stable being, and then just say that's what natural language is.
Right.
Exactly, right?
Right.
And that, you know, I don't see him doing that. Yeah, I see him
more
pointing to, like, almost like the exact problem that you just articulated is that, you know, I even have it written down here, like the shadows of God, that you know, the sort of the centrality that God once played as the book of nature is being distributed across, you know, a plethora of different things. There is the ding on zik called math, the ding on zik called DNA information, the ding on zik of just information writ large. And yeah. You know, the interesting thing about it is it actually gives a model as not like the source of you know, this representational metaphysical schemata is ironically enough also the way of disabling the entire schemata.
But I'll give you an example, because this is where I think all he's doing, like, I think that in many ways we're just spending way too much time on this chunk. I mean, it's perfectly fine, we're building it. I think all he's doing is saying this is a trend and a tendency in a lot of fields to think writing, to think a kind of writing that problematizes the traditional diagram. That's all he's doing.
Yeah.
And because he's not saying they have the radical version at all. Mm-hmm. I'll give you the perfect example is right after the math stuff on page 10. The other example that he points to is one that's really clear, which is, beyond theoretical mathematics, the development of the practical methods of information retrieval extends the possibilities of the message vastly, to the point where it is no longer the written translation of a language, the transporting of a signifier which could return spoken in its integrity. It goes hand in hand with the extension of phonography. He's just talking telephones, right? Like, I mean, all of the things that extend, or recording technologies of any kind. Hand in hand with an extension of phonography and of all the means of conserving the spoken language, of making it function without the presence of a speaking subject, right? Like, so this to me is like, okay, wouldn't that be the amplification of the phoné? And he's like, no, not at all. It's the disconnecting of the phoné from the voice, right? So it's disconnecting a voice from its sense of presence. So in each of these instances, like, what does the sort of spread of telecommunications do? Like, it one of the things that it does is it severs the message from an idea and from an intention and from a sense of God. Like, that's one of its effects.
Right.
So, you know, so, like, now, of course, you could say it is also a means for reappropriating it on a massive scale, right? Mm-hmm. Now we have recordings of people talking and we can get their being there, right? Like,
right.
But he's taking it in the other direction and just saying, look, there are all these symptoms out there happening in a diverse series of fields that are attempting to problematize the traditional diagram. So first thing, let's talk about the traditional diagram, which, of course, turns out to not simply be traditional, right? There is this ontotheological, but then there's also within it the subversion of the ontotheological, which is what enables all of these directions to you know. So it's like there's nothing new to what I'm saying, other than there seems to be a kind of spread or profusion of an interest in this, none of which are terribly radicalized. Mm-hmm. I think to him, it's like, you know, yeah, of course, phonography certainly reappropriates presence, right?
Right.
And installs it. I mean, think of the telecommunication stuff in signature event context, where it's like, yeah, of course, it can always be thought as just an extension of presence by even more powerful means, right? And it can do that, but it has to be able to work at a kind of absoluteness, and the spread of it indicates the possibility of limits, you know?
Right.
Yeah, maybe I'm just too hung up on sort of self-consciousness and intention in here, because, you know, I think of the metaphor of the phonograph, and, you know, that is the pure repetition of, you know, it's of its source. This is a logic of representation, and it's just the most kick-ass one, because if you get the high fidelity system, but like if you care about high fidelity sound, fidelity is right in the name, right. And the only thing that matters is loss and failure, and you know, you sort of like, even with sort of like tens of thousands of dollars worth of, you know, all analog equipment, you know, there's still always a loss from the voice to the recording equipment to its distributions to its production over the speakers, and it's just like the goal is to get as little of that as possible
to maintain the purity of the origin.
Exactly, to maintain the purity of the origin. And now, like, Derrida turns to those kinds of examples precisely to sort of like show this impossibility that's, you know, a feature, not a bug. But I don't think he thinks that anyone else recognizes that. That, like, the people that he's using as examples here think they're doing the exact opposite of what he's saying they're doing.
Right, right.
Yeah, no, I think that that's true. Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily matter, right? At least in terms of deconstruction, right? You don't have to intend to deconstruct your own text. Yeah. It's going to do that work, right? I mean,
but then phonography and biological replication, everything else, would literally be showing the exact same phenomenon as medieval scribes were.
But that's the whole point, Nathaniel. It's always doing both, right? Like, it's not... So in other words, phonography isn't... It is a total reappropriation of the voice, and it also pushes the limits of thinking about the voice. Like, the conditions of possibility, conditions of impossibility.
Well, it's also, right? You could say, like, the example of telecommunications, like, you could say that intensifies or makes explicit or makes apparent the ontological condition that Derrida wants to point out, but you don't need the example. It just sort of, like, the fact that the message is divorced from the speaker, right? That's a condition of writing. It's a condition of speaking over the phone. But it's also, as he will at least eventually say, a condition of speech, right? So that's why writing ends up being primary, because as soon as an utterance slips from the mouth, it's divorced from the subject. And then even prior to that, the sort of... The anti-Hegelian threat is that there's no self-present self-consciousness that intends to make the utterance, right? So there's, it's like... anti-foundationalist to the core, paradoxically.
Right. I mean, what I see is like the convergence of like all of this stuff that seems on the surface to be sort of like maintaining or pointing out the integrity of the core, you know, as sort of like the heralding of the mathematical unit, the heralding of identity, the heralding of information as self-present, you know, knowledge or information just ready for access. Yeah, it does seem like as you push on those limits, you know, Derrida is going to say, ultimately, you are actually making it easier to see the exact opposite, and I'm going to take it in that.
I mean, I totally agree. Like, I think of it in terms of like the digitization of music as an example, right? Like, I remember for a long time it was like, how can this ever be, how can this ever be commodified? Because it doesn't work by an economic logic, right? Like, economic logic means either I have it or you have it. And if I give it to you, either my copy is devalued because it's secondary replication or whatever, right? Like, that's all how the logic of economy works, but not with digital technologies. I can give you a copy that's literally exactly the same as my copy, not degraded in any way at all. And so economy shouldn't work, right? Like, because there's no scarcity, right? And as you amp that up, you can talk about sort of making 3D printing and the implications of all of that. But I mean, so on the one hand, this thing should problematize any notion of economy itself premised on scarcity, because it just doesn't work according to that logic. On the other hand, it's fucking totally clear with Spotify, right? Like, it becomes this, again, inflated version of an economic model. So it's both, right? Like, it's both and, or neither nor, or whatever. I mean, that's where the sort of conditions of possibility, conditions of impossibility, and the question of, you know, which one is phonography? Like, what is this fidelity? Well, it is both an increasing commitment to faithfulness to the origin and the eradication of the relevance of the origin, right? Mm-hmm. It's really doing both of those things, not one or the other.
Right.
And it's so easy to say, I mean, like, as you just did, that, like, your copy and my copy are identical, but they're not, right? I mean, that, you know, they're only identical within an abstract realm of reducing the song to information, which are represented in zeros and ones, right? But, you know, the and so the differences that sort of matter to us, like, they're gone. But that doesn't mean that the differences have been elided. There still is an economy of citationality, right? And the sort citational path of the sort of like the very same song that I put in scare quotes here as it passes through my speaker and your speaker are different. They're just not significant differences for, you know, our economic lives.
I would imagine, and I don't know if Derrida ever did this, because, you know, he died, 15 years ago, you know, like, but... The digitization, the sort of musical digitization, is a really interesting place to me to play this out. And I don't know very much. I mean, this is Boo Boo's realm, but I don't know very much about this at all. But I suspect all of those questions are having to be negotiated, you know, by recording companies, distribution companies, Spotify, bracket the whole, like, Joe Rogan controversies and Neil Young and that sort of shit.
Right.
But it's simply like, it simply becomes a question of how do you make this thing into a product? This thing that doesn't seem to work like most products have always worked.
Yeah.
And it seems like one of the things that Spotify did really well was they were just like, you change the nature of the relationship. Mm-hmm. Nobody buys music anymore.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, we're going to offer something that is a membership and is a club that allows you, or whatever sort of, like, we have to change the whole model of how people listen to music. Mm-hmm. But we can still make it a commodity. We can still appropriate it in a commodifiable form.
Right.
We just have to change the nature of how that commodity operates.
You're buying access, convenience, curation, right? You're not buying... Yeah.
When in fact that access shouldn't be, I mean... If it's digital in this regard, we do, right? We can get access to any music anywhere for nothing.
Yeah.
You don't need Spotify.
Ease of access, convenience
there,
of access.
There
right?
you go, right? So that's the difference. Like, oh, I don't have to go find this somewhere and download it. It's like I just, it's right on Spotify.
The music industry got anti-piracy all wrong at first. They finally figured it out. But like the best anti-piracy isn't to stop piracy. It's to make it less valuable. You know, like how many forays into Derrida are there in composition studies? Like, not
like five,
many. Right? Yeah, like if that, right?
Jasper Neal, Sharon Crowley. Like, I mean, I could probably list them on my
Sanchez, Greg Ulmer. Sanchez, Ulmer,
right? I mean, there's just not very many.
Right. And you know, and I don't think any of them. I mean, I think they all do some interesting things, but none of them really tackle the fundamental sort of. Like the two-pronged relationship between writing and ontotheology and writing and iteration and like its significance to pedagogy, which is supposedly, you know, like one of the cornerstones of composition studies.
Right.
So, you know, like I think that you could write very straightforwardly, like, what are we teaching when we are writing, and how and why does, you know, like, we tend to think of that as a kind of humble activity, and yet it's imported an entire 3,000 years of
ontotheological. You're fucking teaching religion. Like, all of you who go into a composition classroom, whether you understand or realize it or not, you're teaching religion.
Right.
Yes. Right. And the capacity of subverting and mutating religion.
That's right. You're not only teaching religion, but, I mean, at least, you know, it's that, it's like the boo-boo line. Like, at least be aware, at least be attentive that these are the dynamics that are circulating. Like, when you talk about meaning, there's a whole sort of sensibility and history to that. You just think, like, well, what does this sentence mean? You're not just asking a narrow, locatable
technological
question. Right. Like, you're asking a really, really big question. The idea that a word has a meaning, that whole sense brings a lot with it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yes, it's so fully routinized that you're like, why the fuck would anyone ever ask that question? But that's the whole point, is that it's been routinized and repeated, and so you are reproducing a structure, you know?
Right.
But man, I mean, at least for me, it just became clearer than it's ever been, the theological, the explicitly theological connection to every way that we think about language, right? Like, yes. I mean, when he says, I mean, I just remember, I was always like, you know, there's that sort of John from the book of John, like, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Yeah. It's like, oh, that seems kind of interesting and cool, like, big historical connection to language and whatever. It's like, I had no idea. The whole thing, the whole, everything about our understanding of language is, and I mean, I buy this argument. It is just like, and has always been, the very notion of signifier, signified relation is just full on at its core theological. And it can't not be, right? There's no other way. Although, here's my question. If you start thinking of the signifier as constituting the signified, doesn't that change it? Like, because he seems to want to say, right, like that there is, this is the only history, you know, and but doesn't that change things? And again, maybe this is the question of Austin. Right, like why sort of Derrida's critique of performativity is like, yeah, it does something on this register, but it smuggles back in consciousness in terms of the question of context and intention in that register. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe that's the response to it, but it just seems to me like he wants to say, you know, at some level, once you have signifiers and signifieds, the sensible and the intelligible, that dichotomy, which by the way, you cannot have language without that dichotomy. Like, once you have that dichotomy, the whole fucking shebang is onto-theological and will always be. And I'm like, but if you don't see the signified as prior, and if you see as the signifier as in some way, and Saussure does this, right? Saussure says, like, I'm not really sure that there's such a thing as thought prior to language, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that there's some conjunction of the two that's necessary. He doesn't go into it. It's not a determinant. It's not Sapir-Whorf or anything like that. But once you have the idea of the signifier constituting in some way the signified, haven't you changed the diagram, or am I missing something?
Well, for one thing, you're right. I mean, there's a reason why the signifier signified are part of the same coin. That is the sign, right? And yeah, we have to almost think about this at two levels. Like, there's the sign-referent relationship
right,
yeah. is different than the signifier-signified relationship.
Right.
But I think only at the level of level that you could, like, there's not some internal difference between the two that makes, like, I think that you could substitute signifier signified for something like, you know, the word, like the sign cup and the physical cup as well. And it's the exact same logic operative that's governing the relationship between the sound of the word cup and the idea of the cup, of the intelligible right. and sensible, right? Because right. you could infinitely subdivide. To me, you know, there's an infinite capturing and an infinite subdivision allowable for that sign signifier relationship allows for.
But if you take, I mean, so, because I even still provisionally get this point, which is like, let's just take fucking God and truth out of the thing, right? Like, let's just for the moment. And I know
because that's so easy to do, right?
Right, exactly. I know. But let's just totally secularize this as a modern linguist would, right? And say, like, well, look, you have a perception of something, mm-hmm. right? So you and through your perception, you form an idea, right? And that so the idea is formed through the perception. I see a tree right there, right? Like, I form an idea, and then I embed it in a signifier. How is that theological?
Because God is the tree.
Right, no. Well, God is the presence of my mind to the external world, right? Mm-hmm. Like, God is the pure, in other words, that I, when I perceive the tree, the act of perception is creating an identity between the idea, the perception and idea that I'm forming and the thing out there, right? That's the sense of presence.
But even prior to that, there has to be an encapsulatable thing called the tree.
Right, right.
That exists that is, independent of itself, that is the, or like, you know, I think of this as sort of like a chain of like communication chains. And, you know, one of the problems that like Plato runs into, you know, over and over again is that the soul isn't primary enough. The soul is just another
right.
factor in this chain. And, you know, you have to get to phusis to begin with. And then for Plato, you have to go up to the eidos, right? Or to the right. forms, or for the Christian theologian, you have to go to God. And, you know, like, if you think that you're secularizing it, then you can cut off that last layer and be like, no, it's right. just the world as it is.
Already,
but world as it is.
Right. The soul is already derivative, but at least you, at least we have this sense of the soul or mind, like having a primary communication, a primary communication with the presence that is the world, right? Like that is stuff.
But my soul, say like, let's say that I'm communicating, I'm writing about or thinking about or speaking about something that isn't quote unquote external to me. Like say I'm just trying to communicate a feeling, right? I'm angry. Okay. Well, there is the anger qua anger, and then there is my self-articulation of that anger qua anger that unifies me as a subjective being who in my own internal discourse is closest to the God that is anger. And then I continue that chain of communication by uttering I'm really angry, which then gets to you more or less unscathed. But you know, the soul, even in that situation, the voice that is me articulating my anger to myself is still a step removed from the anger qua anger. And
it's a metaphor. But that's a big, again, that's a big presumption. Like, because to me, that's like the kind of pure affect thing for Deleuze, right? Like that there's this affect and then there's consciousness making sense of the affect and calling it anger.
Yes.
And then there's the articulation of it, which is a subsequent and later thing. But yeah, we're stuck in that prior moment of, because I mean, I still feel like God in this diagram is what governs the certainty of the equality of mind and perception. Mm-hmm. Right? Like God is the thing that allows me to be sure that when I see a tree, there's a fucking tree. Or that when I feel something and, you know, like that it's me.
God as creator, God as lawgiver, that was no deceiver, you know, in Descartes' language, that like wouldn't pervert, you know, the communicative lines between them. But then there's also God as ontological source, as being qua being, that would have to stabilize.
That governs the relation, that says what your mind thinks is there. Right, like it's the thing that allows you to make an equation between I see a thing, there's a thing there.
Mm-hmm. Right. That would even have to be secondary, right? Independent of your perception of it, there would have to be a thing there. You would have to have a certain faith that there is a thing there, that it is self-identical, and that it's capable of perception to begin with. Then, and that would, you know, that pure presence is standing in for a God term. Then there's another God term that is sort of like governing the possibility of my perception of that thing having a one-to-one correlation with it. So it's like, there's a thing there and I have a perception of it, but I need some kind of faith in a God-like mechanism or natural resemblance or whatever else that, you know, the thing that I am perceiving is a perception of it in its reality.
So let's go to page 13.
Yeah.
And this is just after he says, look, you can't have a notion of the sign without having a difference between the signifier and signified. Like every version has to have something like that, some version of the sensible, Augustine intelligible.
This,
right. And he says, like, look, this is not just, you know, the religious old school prejudice ones. This is like the modern examples of linguistics. And he reads Jakobson, Roman Jakobson there. And he says basically the same thing that Saussure says, which is the difference between the signifier and signified. This is the big quote on 13 in the middle of 13 there that has the Jakobson quote there. He doesn't say it's Jakobson, but it's Jakobson.
This is actually at the bottom of 12 for me. It begins the ideal motion.
No, as modern structural thought has clearly realized.
No, I'm on a different. Oh yeah, okay, that's 14 for me. Yeah, okay.
Okay, and so the paragraph underneath that. So, but I mean, he has just said sensible, intelligible, and it's there. So, yes. But to these metaphysico-theological roots, many other hidden sentiments cling. There he's just pointing out the necessity of the sensible, intelligible divide. Like, you just have to have that to have language, right? The semiological, or more specifically, linguistic science cannot, therefore, hold on to the difference between signifier and signified, which is the very idea of the sign, without the difference between sensible, intelligible. Certainly, he's just pointed that out. And this is the part, but also not without retaining more profoundly and more implicitly, and by the same token, the reference to a signified able to take place in its intelligibility before its fall, before any expulsion into the exteriority of the sensible here below. which is just to have the idea of something, right? Like to have the pure signified. Well, this is the transcendental signified, right? Like a signified, at least the implicit possibility of a pure signified. So as the face of pure intelligibility, it refers to an absolute logos to which it is immediately united. This absolute logos was an infinite creative subjectivity in medieval theology. The intelligible face of the sign remains turned toward the word and the face of God.
Right.
So in that case, to me, what he's saying there is the idea, the signified is just an idea in your, any idea, which I think would include a perception, right? Like any idea.
Yeah. I agree with that, yeah.
So that's a signified, even prior to my forming it into a word, even in my head, right? So it's like, because that's one of the arguments, like the Steven Pinker and other folks are like, we can have ideas prior to, prior to language, right? Like prior to any kind of language, we have ideas, and this whole linguistic determinism thing is bullshit, you know? Mm-hmm. But it's like, they're actually arguing for the transcendental signified, this notion of a sort of pure idea and pure presence that is, again, here would be the question that I would say is, why is that theological? I get that it has been theological, but why is that necessarily theological? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like, I mean, so what you're talking about is a sign without the need for a referent, right?
Without any kind of referent.
Yeah, so even, but I mean, which, well, I think it's theological in at least two ways. I mean, one, historically, I'll get to the necessity of it in a second, but I think historically speaking, it's theological in like the foundation of rationalism writ large is that God pre-programs us with clear and distinct ideas that we can come to without any empirical
But nobody believes that shit anymore. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but let's think of this not in some sort of prehistory time when religion tainted all versions of the episteme and everybody thought that everything was fucking God manifesting himself. Let's think of this in the context of a fully atheistic, secularized, scientist who's studying whatever.
Mm. Well, I mean, even I think contemporary scientists would have a problem with the notion of the tabula rasa, right? That, biological, genetic sort of, composition sort of, pre-shape, our capacity to engage.
Right, well, so, but you can... ideas is just so, but you could just say like, well, look, this has nothing to do with the theological things that you're talking about. This is just the way that the mind works. The mind, the human brain, creates images when it perceives. When you have like the Nietzsche, sensory data hits. There's some neuronal thing, and you form an idea. Like, what's theological about that?
I mean that there's some predetermining structure that's. That upholds it. That's the historical argument. But I think the more logically necessary argument is that what does the sign present itself to? That you need a sense of absolute interiority and absolute exteriority for something like the purity of a sign without a referent that presents itself to an autonomous, bounded subject. And I think it's that purity of relation that is theological. And in fact, I would even say that is theological prior to, that is the most foundational theology. Like the very conception of God requires that logic. It's the condition of possibility for what we would call like any particular theology.
He does point out there's a little aside here on 17 that I think is really great on the point that you're just making, which is, natural writing, this is right after the quote, the Bible is the most sublime book. Yeah. So it's probably maybe on 18 for you, I don't know. But natural writing is immediately united to the voice and to breath. Its nature is not grammatological, but pneumatological. It is hieratic, very close to the interior, the holy voice, etc., etc. There's much to say about the fact that the native unity of the voice and writing is prescriptive, right? Arche speech is writing because it is a law. And I thought that was a really interesting, it's just an aside point that he's making, which is that, think about when we think of interior voices, we think of it as the call of conscience. That would be the most common way that we come to understand it. And it's always prescriptive, right? It is always don't do that, right? Yeah. Like the sort of, you know, Socratic daemon version. But mm-hmm. that our notion of an interior voice is always a legislator, right?
To the voice that one hears upon retreating into oneself. I mean, but that is, yeah. you know, he talks about like the holy of holies. That is the most uniquely you, the one that is untainted. Like, think about the commonplace phrases that's attached to. Like, be yourself, listen to yourself, know thyself, right? Like, you know, like when someone tells you in your high school yearbook, don't ever change, you know, it's like, find that, you know, that you know,
the
centering.
The pure kernel of selfness,
yeah, right? the pure kernel of selfness, right? And it's telling to me, too, back on my 14, it might be your 13 or early 14, but it's the second paragraph after that Jakobsen quote that you had us on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of course, it is not a question of rejecting these notions. They are necessary, and today, at least for us, not a thing.
Yeah, but that's a different translation. Who's that translation? Who's that translation? That's a different translation.
This is Spivak. I think I have. I think it's the 40th anniversary edition.
Because you're just reading that for instance, and it's minor, the changes, but there are changes.
Yeah.
There.
No, I noticed it when I was reading with yours, but they're very small, like a word here or there.
Yeah. Right.
But let me just here. It is a question.
Nothing is conceivable. Yeah. Go ahead.
It is a question at first of making evident the systematic and historical solidarity of concepts and gestures, of thought that one often believes to be able to be separate innocently. The sign and divinity have the same place and time of birth. The epoch of the sign is essentially theological. Perhaps it will never end. Its historical closure is, however, designated. And like one way of thinking of this is that like theology exists first and then, you know, signs sort of emerge from it, and that's what makes all signs theological. I think you could say the exact opposite as well, is that the very conception of the sign allows forward a concept of divinity as pure presence, and there, and then as soon as you have to think about the communication of pure presence going beyond itself at all, you're into this logic.
But why couldn't you say, I mean, I'm being a devil's advocate, but I'm being a devil's advocate in part because I feel like I'm just not comfortable with those kinds of claims. Why couldn't you say that voice that I hear that tells me not to do something or whatever else, like, that, why does that have to be theological? Why can't that be, yes, we could call it still things like my true self, my inner self, my inmost interior essence or whatever. But why couldn't I say that inmost interior essence is a product of who I've been and who I've become and all of the things that I've done, right? Like, why does it have to be an absolute, universal, ahistorical, theological? Like, why can't it be just, so yeah, I have a voice of conscience because of the person that I am, right? Because of the way that I've moved in the world, right? So yeah, my interior voice, it's real. It is, and it is my true self, but it's my true self,
because
not
tainted,
as some...
John. It's been tainted by exposure to
fine,
the
but
not
I'd be
you.
Okay. But I'm saying I'm totally okay with that. It's like, yes, so what I am is always in relation and has always been sort of spinning out in interactions with all sorts of alterity.
But you would have to have quotation marks around I, because you could not fully bound it.
Well, I'm fine
say,
with that. But I'm
oh,
fine
I'm fine with
that
too, right? But you see that if... Yeah. You have to
but
change the logic.
But I think a lot
logic.
Of people would be fine with that, right? Like, I think, for instance, that's where, to me, this feels caricatured, right? Like, I think mm-hmm. a lot of people would be okay with the idea of, like, your true self, it would be a different true self had you been born somewhere else. It would still be a true self. It would still be the voice of conscience. It would still be the interior essence. But it would be an essence constituted by relationality and action and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Think about how scary that is. Oh, so go for it, Nate.
No, I mean, I was.
Why is that scary?
Say,
that seems great.
I mean,
no, I think it's great, but
you're investing the notion of self or the essence of self with mobility and with the constitutive relationality that at least Derrida's not like the in the traditional notion of like the essence of self. It would be eternal, not mobile.
That's right.
Not even affected by otherness necessarily.
But I'm not even sure that that's true, right? Like, here's what I'm saying is I'm not sure that Derrida isn't strawmanning Western
caricaturing
history.
Caricaturing, yeah.
You know, not, I mean, straw manning is too strong a word. And again, I'm not, but like, it just doesn't seem that the idea that I'm pointing out here doesn't seem ridiculous. I'm not saying that everyone agrees with it, no. But it just doesn't, it seems like something that one could assume a notion of a true self, a voice of conscience that has no connection, right, to any kind of absoluteness or any kind of durability.